Today is Wednesday, November the 22nd, 2023. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how big tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer industry news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40 years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. The Personal Computer Show had for many years been a call-in talk show. The pandemic-causing studio lockdown has altered our format. The listener call-in format enabled us to know what technology issues were on the minds of the listeners. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's www.prn.live. That's L-I-V-E. Streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The end of the Microsoft standalone application. Microsoft has made the decision to pull cloud support from Office 2016 and 2019, signaling a shift away from standalone software that users can own. This move aligns with the growing dominance of software as a service in the end-user software market. Adobe, for example, transitioned to a subscription-based model with Creative Cloud, requiring users to subscribe rather than purchasing a permanent version of their programs. Microsoft has actively discouraged users from buying Office 2019, indicating a shift away from PC-based programs. Furthermore, Microsoft announced that as of October the 10th, 2023, it would no longer support the connectivity of Office 2016 and 2019 to Microsoft 365, further closing the door on standalone software. This shift towards cloud-based subscriptions reflects the industry trend of moving away from standalone applications and towards software as a service models. While this may have implications for users who prefer to own their software outright, it also offers benefits such as regular updates, access to cloud storage, and the ability to use the software across multiple devices. It's important the impact of Microsoft's decision to withdraw cloud support from Office 2016 and 2019 has several implications for users. Firstly, users who are still running these versions of Office may experience performance or reliability issues over time, as the connections to Microsoft 365 service will no longer be supported. This means that users may not be able to connect with services such as Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, and OneDrive for Business. Additionally, improvements to Microsoft 365 services will no longer be tested with Office 2016 and 2019. This lack of testing may result in compatibility issues and a potential lack of access to new features and updates. Users who were expecting support for Office 2019 and 2016 for an additional 2 years, as promised in their contracts and end-user license agreements, that's the EULAs, may be disappointed to find that they now have no guarantee of connectivity to Microsoft's own services for the full duration they paid for. Furthermore, there will be no extended security update program for Office 2016 and 2019, leaving the lifespan of these versions up in the air. Microsoft's recommendation in light of these changes recommends that users consider upgrading to Microsoft 365 E3. This subscription-based service offers Microsoft 365 app for desktop at a cost of $36 per month. Alternatively, users who are willing to work with a web-based version of Office can subscribe to Office 365 E3 for $23 per month. While this recommendation may not be ideal for users who prefer to own their software outright, it does offer benefits such as regular updates, access to cloud storage, and the ability to use the software across multiple devices. What alternatives do you have? Well, there are other Office products, and you may want to look into it, and I will comment on these in future broadcasts. New York's potential ban on non-compete employment agreements. New York is considering a ban on non-compete employment agreements, and the New York legislature passed a bill in June of 2023 that would prohibit non-compete agreements, but it has not been signed into law yet. If enacted, the ban could have a broad scope and impact companies based in New York. What is the current status and opposition? As of the current operating time, Governor Kathy Hochul has not made a decision on whether she intends to sign the legislation. The bill has faced fierce opposition from business groups, including the Public Policy Institute of the State of New York, which launched a $1 million ad campaign to thwart the legislation. Wall Street firms, in particular, have voiced concerns about the potential ban as they see non-compete agreements as important for protecting investment strategies and preventing highly paid workers from leaving with valuable inside information. Supporters of a ban argue that non-compete agreements can be detrimental to workers and innovation. They believe that banning these agreements would provide employees with more flexibility and agency when considering other employment opportunities. They point to examples like Silicon Valley in California, where the absence of non-compete agreements has allowed for greater flexibility and growth in the tech industry. If the ban is signed into law, it would only affect non-compete agreements signed after the law goes into effect. The legislation would not restrict non-disclosure agreements that currently exist. Business groups argue that the ban should not apply to certain industries and job levels, such as top executives or partners in tech companies or law firms. They also express concerns that the ban could lead to job outsourcing to states without similar laws, such as Florida and Texas. New York is not the only state considering restrictions on non-compete agreements. Several states have already implemented bans or restrictions on these agreements. For example, California, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Oklahoma have banned non-compete agreements entirely. Other states have implemented restrictions such as setting a compensation threshold or requiring advance notice. There are federal efforts to address non-compete agreements. The Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC, proposed a regulation in January of this year that would ban non-compete agreements at the federal level. The FTC argues that these agreements harm workers by blocking them from taking better jobs and getting better pay and benefits in the same field. However, the proposed regulation has not been enacted yet. To recap, New York is considering a ban on non-compete employment agreements, but the legislation has not been signed into law yet. The potential ban has faced opposition from business groups, while supporters argue that they would benefit workers and innovation. Other states have already implemented bans or restrictions on non-compete agreements, and the Federal Trade Commission has proposed a federal regulation to address the issue. There is so much drama that's happening with artificial intelligence. OpenAI turmoil and Sam Altman's firing. OpenAI is an American artificial intelligence research and deployment company with the stated goal of ensuring that artificial general intelligence, that's AGI, benefits all of humanity. OpenAI researches AI with the stated intention of developing a safe and beneficial AGI, which it defines as highly autonomous systems that outperform humans at most economically valuable work. In March of 2019, OpenAI transitioned from a nonprofit to a for-profit company, with a cap on profits to ensure that the company remains focused on its mission. Microsoft has invested $1 billion in OpenAI. OpenAI is a leading player in the field of AI research, and its work has the potential to have a profound impact on the future of society. The company is committed to developing AI that is safe and beneficial for all of humanity. Well, last Friday, OpenAI's Sam Altman, who was the founder of the company, was fired as CEO because the board that consisted of six people no longer has confidence in his ability to lead. OpenAI's board of directors said last Friday that Sam Altman will step down as CEO and will be replaced by Chief Technology Officer Mira Murathi. The board no longer has confidence in his ability to continue leading OpenAI. The company said it conducted a deliberative review process and concluded that he was not consistently candid in his communications with the board, hindering its ability to exercise its responsibilities. The board no longer has confidence in his ability to continue leading OpenAI, the statement said. OpenAI says the board of its 501c3 is the overall governing body for all OpenAI activities. The board also said that Greg Brockman, OpenAI's president, will be stepping down as chair of the board. Sam Altman acknowledged that he was leaving OpenAI, but did not mention any accusations by the firm's board that he failed to be candid during unspecified reviews. He said he loved working at the company and he would talk more about what's next later. By the way, with all these accusations, we still don't know what the reasons were. The next day, on Saturday, according to recent reports, 500 employees of OpenAI have threatened to resign unless the company's board steps down and reinstates Sam Altman. The employees are expressing their dissatisfaction with the handling of Altman's firing and are demanding changes within the company's leadership. The situation is still developing, and it remains to be seen how OpenAI will respond to these demands. This was followed by reports there have been discussions between the OpenAI board and former CEO Sam Altman regarding his potential return to the company. After Altman's surprise ousting, there have been reports of attempts to rehire him. The situation involves negotiations for Altman to return as CEO, with the possibility of the OpenAI nonprofit board resigning as part of the deal. Microsoft, a significant investor in OpenAI, has played a role in these developments along with other investors and company employees. Microsoft's involvement in OpenAI is notable. The software giant has committed at least $13 billion to OpenAI since 2019 and has significant power over the startup. However, Microsoft does not have a seat on the OpenAI board, highlighting the complex governance structure of the organization. OpenAI's financial situation is also a factor in the turmoil. While the company is reportedly making about $80 million per month and may reach $1 billion in revenue in 2023, it is unclear if the company is profitable or what its burn rate is. OpenAI lost $540 million in 2022 on revenue of less than $30 million for the entire year. The company relies on continual support from Microsoft to keep operating. The dependence on Microsoft extends beyond financial support. OpenAI relies on Microsoft's cloud computing data centers to train and run its models. This reliance gives Microsoft significant control over OpenAI's access to computing power and funding. Although they don't have a seat, they really have quite a bit of power over the company. The governance structure of OpenAI has come under scrutiny. The convoluted structure involves multiple entities, including a limited liability corporation, majority owned by a holding company, jointly owned by OpenAI's nonprofit board, employees, and venture capital investors. The nonprofit board controls the holding company, and Microsoft and other financial backers do not have a seat at the table when it comes to hiring and firing the CEO. The situation at OpenAI highlights the challenges of balancing financial support and control from big tech corporations while maintaining independence and fulfilling the organization's mission. OpenAI was founded as a nonprofit entity to develop artificial intelligence, that's AGI, for the benefit of all humanity, with the aim of preventing a single corporation from monopolizing AGI. However, the pursuit of AGI requires significant resources, and OpenAI turned to venture capital and major cloud service providers like Microsoft for funding and computing power. Late breaking news. Sam Altman returns to OpenAI. Sam Altman was reinstated as OpenAI's chief executive today, Wednesday, November the 22nd, days after the organization board of directors fired him. The dismissal was the result of a growing rift between Altman and other board members regarding the company's direction and the potential risks its technology posed to society. Altman's return was made possible through an agreement reached with OpenAI, which included an overhaul of the board of directors. The only holdover from the previous board is Adam D'Angelo, the CEO of Quora. OpenAI's unique structure, which includes a board of directors, played a role in Altman's dismissal. Some board members expressed concerns about the potential dangers of OpenAI's technology and felt that Altman was not adequately addressing these risks. Instead, they believe Altman was more focused on building OpenAI's business. This disagreement ultimately led to Altman's ouster from the company. Speculation about Altman's return to OpenAI began shortly after his dismissal last Friday, with reports suggesting that he would only return under certain conditions. These conditions included the removal of the board of directors and an overhaul of OpenAI's governance rules. In the agreement reached between Altman and OpenAI, the company agreed to reorganize the board of directors to facilitate Altman's return. It is unclear at this time if OpenAI's governance rules will also be changed to strengthen Altman's position. Altman's return to OpenAI came after nearly all of the company's 800 employees threatened to resign and follow Altman to Microsoft. These employees also signed an open letter calling for the board to quit, accusing it of being incapable of overseeing OpenAI. The employee unrest and the threat of mass resignations likely played a significant role in the board's decision to reinstate Altman as CEO. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I spend just a few minutes talking about computers, the workplace, and some of the things that IT professionals have done for us, and sometimes to us. Click on all of the items that show bridges. Okay, all right, there's a big bridge here, and you click, click, click. Oh, wait, is the antenna? Is that antenna on top of the bridge part of the bridge? Who drives this? Companies. No, actually, IT departments. We've developed this security that is there to protect our Amazon accounts. But sometimes this CAPTCHA item is used on something as simple as signing up for a newsletter, about finding out more information about our health, about all kinds of different things that maybe aren't all that necessary for us to go through the 20 questions. Click on all of the items that show buses. Click, click, click. This rearview mirror is here. Is that part of that big red bus? What about, okay, I recognize it. That's the emergency hatch on top of the bus, but they open that up sometimes when the air conditioner breaks. Is that part of the bus? You know, in our harried existence, in our day-to-day workings and dealings, do we really want to slow down for something that's not really important for us, for something that's insignificant? Or do we want to give up sometimes with all of this madness? Click on all of the items that show motorcycles. Okay, click, click, click. Wait, I recognize that little small item right there. It's in this image, and it's really small, but it's someone sitting on a motorcycle. And I recognize the motorcycle shape and all of that. And many people would miss that. So am I skipping it? or am I including it? Why are we upsetting people when we have to go through and have them do 4 iterations of clicking and proving that we're not robots to something that is automated and is a robot? Why are we doing this? Click all of the items that show a car. Click, 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 click. Wait, is that a pickup or is that a car? Am I sure? Well, are they considering it a pickup or a car? I have no clue. I've had to perform these on many key items, and that frustrates me. You know, I need to move on with this banking item, and I have limited time. And here it is asking me 20 questions about which of these show blue skies versus cloudy skies. Although some of these could be, well, is this hazy or smoky? Okay, some of these are clearly fluffy clouds. Okay, so, but do we consider partly cloudy with a couple of scattered clouds? Is that blue skies? I don't know. And what about some of these? Some of these look black and white. Now, what about somebody who is colorblind? This is an area where we have struggled. This is an area where IT has not been keeping pace with these. Problems abound with these ideas of we're supposed to identify that we're not a robot, but yet we're sitting here doing mundane robotic tasks. Click all of the items that show a 1983 Honda Civic Accord. Okay, click, click. Wait, is that a Honda or a Toyota? I don't know. They all kind of look alike. I don't know. Wait, what about this one? Is this a Honda Civic or Honda CRX? I only see the front half, and they both look really similar. Oh, here's one. Yes, that's definitely a Honda Civic Accord. Wait, is it 1983, which is what they're looking for? Is this a 1984 or 1982? Okay, I will admit that I am guilty of installing these CAPTCHA widgets as well. Each of them has some level of fault to them. The one that asks me a question about grammar is going to be quite fine, but what about the one that asks someone to perform what amounts to algebraic equations? Okay, so 128 times 742. Okay, I'm going to have to get out the calculator for this. Okay, that's not an algebraic equation, but you get the idea. What about asking someone who is dyslexic which word is a synonym for this other word? Okay, these people are going to struggle. We are all reaching that area, that level where we are struggling with CAPTCHA. All of us. This is a problem that's been around for quite a while. It's not good business, and it's going to get worse as so-called artificial intelligence, and it's so-called because of the intelligence and not the artificial. We know it's artificial, but it's so-called intelligence. As it gets better, we're going to have to jump through bigger hoops. The questions will get harder from here, more intrusive, and they will leave us struggling as the computers learn how to beat CAPTCHA, which is generated by, oh yeah, computers. Click on all of the items that exist within 10 miles of your home. Well, that's kind of intrusive. How do you know where I'm at? Click all of the items that show a portion of your personal fingerprint. Yeah, that gets a little creepy. Click on all of the items that show a portion of your personal DNA. Look, a long time ago, this was good business. It was promoted as tech, having a way to move us forward for a little while and being secure. It was innovative and more. But today, I'll admit that the nerds, myself included, have let the greater public down. On behalf of all of the nerds out there that know better, I'd like to apologize for our failings today for not finding something better. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Xerox PARC's invention of Ethernet is still going strong after 50 years. In late 1969, Peter McAuliffe, chairman of Xerox Corporation, told the New York Society of Security Analysts that Xerox was determined to develop the architecture of information to solve the problems that had been created by the knowledge explosion. The result was the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, with the acronym of PARC, P-A-R-C, in California, one of the most unusual corporate research organizations of our time. PARC is one of three research centers within Xerox. The other two are in Webster, New York, and Toronto, Ontario, Canada. PARC originated or nurtured technologies led to these developments, among others. The Macintosh computer with its mouse and overlapping windows, colorful weather maps on TV news programs, laser printers, structured VLSI design now taught in more than 100 universities, networks that link personal computers in offices, semiconductor lasers that read and write optical disk, and structured programming languages like Modular 2 and Ada. In the mid-1970s, close to half of the top 100 computer scientists in the world were working at PARC, and the laboratory boasted similar strength in other fields, including solid-state physics and optics. When the center opened in 1970, it was unlike other major industrial research laboratories. Its work wasn't tied, even loosely, to its corporate parents' current product lines. And unlike university research laboratories, PARC had one unifying vision. It would develop the architecture of information. Research projects at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center had their roots in many places, including projects funded by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, otherwise known as DARPA, and the University of Utah and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The ideas developed at PARC found their way into a number of commercial products, companies, and publications. Some of these real-world offspring, like the Apple Lisa computer and the Hewlett-Packard LaserJet printer, took many of their root concepts from others, like the Ada computer language and the Intel 1103 dynamic RAM chip, are less closely related. So almost everyone who joined PARC in its formative years had a different idea of what the center's charter was. This had its advantages. Since projects were not assigned from above, the researchers formed their own groups. Support for a project depended on how many people its instigator could get to work on it. When Jack Goldman set up PARC, one of his first decisions was to ask George Paik, a longtime friend, to run it. Paik was executive vice chancellor, provost, and professor of physics at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. One of the first decisions Paik in turn made was to hire, among others, Robert Taylor, then at the University of Utah, to help him recruit engineers and scientists for the computer science and systems science laboratories. PARC started with a small nucleus, perhaps fewer than 20 people. 9 came from the Berkeley Computer Corporation, a small mainframe computer company. The 20 PARC employees were housed in a small rented building with rented chairs, rented desks, a telephone with 4 buttons on it, and no receptionist. The group thought it should have a computer of its own, though. The computer they wanted was a PDP-10 from Digital Equipment Corporation. They decided that it would take 3 years for them to build a good operating system, while they could also build an entire PDP-10 in just 1 year. The result was MAXC, that's M-A-X-C, acronym for Multiple Access Xerox Computer, which emulated the PDP-10 but used semiconductor dynamic RAMs instead of core. One of the blood oaths that was taken by the original founders was that we would never do a system that wasn't engineered for 100 users, said Alan Kay, who led the design and development of the first modern Windows computer desktop interface. That meant that if it was a time-sharing system, you had to run 100 people on it. If it was a programming language, 100 people had to program in it without having their hands constantly held. If it was a personal computer, you had to be able to build at least 100 of them. Systems research requires building systems, he said. Otherwise, you don't know whether the ideas you have are any good or how difficult they are to implement. But there are people who think that when you are building things, you're not doing research. The first personal computer developed in the United States is commonly thought to be the Mitz Altair, which sold as a hobbyist kit in 1976. At nearly the same time, the Apple I became available, also in kit form. But by the end of that year, there were also 200 Alto personal computers in daily use, the first of them having been built in 1973, and in September of 1972, researchers Butler Lamson and Chuck Thacker of Parks Computer Science Laboratory went to Alan Kay in the Systems Science Laboratory and asked, "Do you have any money?" Kay told him that he had about, $250,000, earmarked for more Nova 800s and character generation hardware. "How would you like us to build you a computer?" Lamson asked Kay. "I like it a lot," Kay replied. And on November 22, 1972, Thacker and Ed McCrite began building what was to become the Alto. A Xerox executive reportedly angered Thacker by insisting that it would take 18 months to develop a major hardware system. When Thacker argued that he can do it in 3 months, a bet was placed. It took a little longer than 3 months, but not much. On April Fool's Day, 1973, Thornburg recalled, "I walked into the basement and where the prototype Alto was sitting." The reason the Alto could be built so quickly was its simplicity. The processor, recalled Kay, was hardly more than a clock. Only 160 chips in 1973's primitive integrated circuit technology. In 1973, every researcher at Park wanted an Alto personal computer. With that was also the need to have them communicate with each other. Ethernet's development began in 1973 when Charles P. Thacker, who was working on the design of the Alto computer, envisioned a network that would allow Altos to communicate with each other, as well as with laser printers and with Park's gateway to the ARPANET. Park researcher Robert M. Metcalf took on the challenge of creating the technology. Bob Metcalf soon was joined by computer scientist David Boggs. Metcalf and Boggs had two criteria. The network had to be fast enough to support the laser printer, and it had to connect hundreds of computers within the same building. The Ethernet design was inspired by the Additive Links Online Hawaii Area Network, otherwise known as AlohaNet, a radio-based system at the University of Hawaii. Computers transmitted packets prefaced by the addresses of the recipients over a shared channel as soon as they had information to send. If two messages collide, the computers that sent them would wait a random interval and try again. Bob Metcalf outlined his proposal, then called the Alto Aloha Network in a now famous memo to his colleagues. Using coaxial cables rather than radio waves would allow faster transmission of data and limit interference. The cables also meant that users could join or exit the network without having to shut off the entire system. There was something called a cable television tap, which allows one to tap into a coax without cutting it, Metcalf said. Therefore, Boggs and I, meaning Metcalf, chose coax as our means of communication. In the memo, he described the principles of operation: very distributed, no central control, and a single piece of ether. Metcalf and Boggs designed the first version of what is now known as Ethernet in 1973. It sent data at up to 2.94 megabits per second and was fast enough to feed the laser printer and easy to send through the coax. A 9.5 millimeter thick and stiff coaxial cable was laid in the middle of the hall in the Park building. The 500 meter cable had 100 transceiver nodes attached to it, with N connectors known as vampire taps. Each of the taps, small boxes with a hard shell, had two probes that bit through the cable's outer insulation to contact its copper core. Thus, new nodes could be added while existing connections were live. Each vampire tap had a D-type connector socket on it, consisting of a plug with 9 pins that matched to a socket with 9 jacks. The sockets allow Alto computers, printers, and file servers to attach to the network. To enable the devices to communicate, Metcalf and Boggs created the first high-speed network interface card, a circuit board, otherwise we call NIC, which was connected to a computer's motherboard. It included what is now known as an Ethernet port. The researchers changed the name from the original Alto Aloha network to Ethernet to make it clearer that the system could support any computer. Metcalf, Boggs, Thacker, and Butler, W. Lamson, were granted a U.S. patent in 1978 for the invention. They continued to develop the technology, and in 1980, Park released Ethernet that ran at 10 megabits per second. The update was done in collaboration with researchers at Intel and the Digital Equipment Corporation to create a version of Ethernet for the broad industry use, according to the milestone entry. Ethernet became commercially available in 1980 and quickly grew into the industry land standard. To provide computer companies with a framework for the technology, in June of 1983, Ethernet was adopted as a standard by the IEEE 802 Local Area Network Standards Committee. Currently, the IEEE 802 family consists of 67 published standards with 49 projects under development. The committee works with standard agencies worldwide to publish a certain IEEE 802 standards as international guidelines. On Tuesday, April the 25th of this year, 2023, Xerox donated the iconic Palo Alto Research Center, PARC, in California to SRI International, a nonprofit scientific research institute. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston is in the middle of giving us, he and I have been discussing a lot of these different things for our Computer Talk Radio holiday gift guide. And Marty, I see that the next thing is something that actually my wife would be very interested in.
Well, I'm sure she would,
is,
yeah.
She's definitely looking in, she's learning how to grow things a lot of this planter stuff you and I have been talking about, just a matter of turning your black thumb into a green thumb and all of that. So let's dive into this.
Mine's been black and blue for decades, but, automation.
Yeah.
Automation. Speaking about it, is automation a growth industry?
Yes.
Well, it depends on what you're growing.
Yeah.
Tusco, that's T-U-S-C-O. Tusco Products sent a big 20-inch modern colonial style self-watering planter. It's made of rotation molded black polyethylene plastic, meaning weather resistant. It also is fade fighting, UV resistant.
Okay.
It's got a built-in way to help automate watering. The planter exterior is a double wall that creates an internal water reservoir.
Okay.
You fill it through a 3/4 inch top hole. When you follow instructions, you drill a second 3/4 inch hole no lower than 7 inches from the bottom.
Okay.
That creates an overflow drain to limit the water level within the planter. The bottom quarter to third of the planter gets a filler like lava rock, so you don't need as much potting soil. The water feeds from across the bottom to wick up through the soil. That's a method called, for those of you making notes, sub-irrigation. It will be on the final. So the plant essentially self-waters in a way that's less stressful to the root ball, more consistent for the foliage, and helps any blooms endure longer.
Okay.
The Tusco 20-inch self-watering planter is about $140 at Amazon.
Okay. You didn't even tell me there was going to be a quiz or a test. You're talking about finals here.
It's a snap quiz.
Oh, man. Now, if only we could, test something out, test how good the weatherman is. You know, these guys at times are just horrible. I want your guidance on this one.
Oh, you have fun to ask. Our newest outdoor weather station is an Accurite Iris 5-in-1 outdoor unit.
Okay.
And the five are temperature, humidity, wind speed, wind direction, and rainfall. And it comes with a direct-to-Wi-Fi color display that adds indoor temperature, rainfall totals, barometric pressure trends, and a hyperlocal 12-hour forecast, plus a moon phase image and a digital time of day clock and calendar.
Okay.
Wi-Fi can connect it to Weather Underground to share.
Nice.
And for you and the family to the MyAccurite app with its own comprehensive weather dashboard.
Okay.
You can also, because I know you like to talk to things, ask Google Assistant or Alexa. I mounted the outdoor unit on a metal pole in the yard. The self-emptying rain gauge is cool, and the solar power cells run an internal fan that pulls in a bigger sample of surrounding air, which also helps the internal lithium AAs last a long time, maybe 2 years or more. For the holidays, kids with an interest in weather will love this. So will grown-ups with a need to be ready for whatever the day holds, especially with weather info from the station right in their own yard. The Accurite Iris weather station with direct Wi-Fi display is about $170 at Accurite. That's ACURITE.com. ACURITE.
All right. You know, this, I like that idea. This is something that so I moved from Southern California where everything was, okay, it's sunny today and tomorrow will be sunny and the next day will be sunny and the next day will be, yes, you guessed it, sunny. So I moved to the Midwest and, yeah, we have weather here.
Yes,
more than just sunny. It was actually a very weird adaptation process.
You were just spoiled by Anaheim.
Yeah, exactly. Very true. Very true. All right. So what else do we have going on?
Well, everybody needs this, but nobody ever thinks of it.
Yes.
Got a Dremel?
Yes. Not only do I have a Dremel, I've got one Dremel tool. My wife has two Dremel tools.
Still have all the accessory pieces?
Oh, and then some. Yeah.
Or did you use them up or lose them?
I don't lose them, but I do use some of them up. Yes.
Think about who might appreciate getting the Dremel 130-piece accessory kit.
Okay. That's a sizable kit.
Yeah, durable metal pieces like mandrels plus replacements for the pieces mm-hmm, that wear mm-hmm, out when mm-hmm. cleaning and polishing, sanding, cutting, carving, engraving, and sculpting, plus a box to hold it all.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's taking the rough edges off of a 3D print or off of your fingernails,
yes,
or cleaning off places where corrosion collects, a fresh set of accessories gives any Dremel rotary tool a new lease on life. The 130-piece set, part number 730CS, is about $26. And let me jump right into a handy tool to keep around. It's the MagnetPal, telescoping magnet stick with camera. It's a telescoping rod that goes from less than a foot to more than a yard. And about the only person who won't get a kick out of this gadget is Inspector Gadget. I mean, would you like to be able to see what's under a car without bending over or what's in a wall without tearing it open?
Okay.
This is from MagnetPal. Yes, there is a magnet at one end, but there's a lot more. There's a white LED and an HD camera inside the magnet, which is mounted on a few inches of flexing gooseneck at one end of that telescoping rod. It opens up. You push a button, it feeds video to your phone, and you can see what that magnet is looking at. There's a rubber handle grip at your end, a USB charging port, a power button for the camera, low-power Wi-Fi inside, and the app can wander up to 50 feet away. It's still display what the camera sees in 1080p HD. The MagnetPal telescoping magnet stick with camera is about $80 online at MagnetPal.com. Okay. I've had magnet pals and magnet sticks for a long time, but not with a camera. And
that camera really adds in. I was seriously, you know, hitting my interest levels there. Like, okay, I can't tell you how many times I've dropped things down into just inaccessible places.
Well, magnets and claws and all the stuff we use because we don't bend so well anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
But to add in the cameras is just another whole level of genius, because I can't tell you how many times I've reached for something like that in an engine and you don't know where it is. You're just poking down there and all of that and hoping the magnet or the claw will get it. And we are in the middle of our Computer Talk Radio Holiday Gift Guide. Marty Winston is here and has been here. He's covered a number of different products. What's the next one on the list here?
Well, we've paid so much attention to the rest of the family. Let's speak to the geeks and nerds out there now.
Yes, yes.
Now, I first encountered Homey, the brand, not the slang term. This is Homey.
Yeah.
When I was designing a cybernetic house.
Okay.
And there were so many non-intercompatible home automation wireless protocols.
Oh, don't even get me started about those.
Yeah.
Oh,
none of them, not one could provide a very good answer. Homey was something of a Rosetta Stone to that Tower of Babel.
Okay.
Now, fast forward to now, and the new Homey Pro kicks everything up a lot of notches.
Mm-hmm.
It's a home automation homogenizer that lets you connect things on a broad mix of protocols, Zigbee, Z-Wave, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, infrared, Matter, and soon, if not already, Thread.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they sent me some simple devices to help prove that it really works, but I was more excited to see that it can connect to my AirThings Wave radon and IAQ monitor, indoor air quality.
Oh, nice. Okay.
To my Weatherflow Tempest outdoor weather station, my Eufy security cameras, and more. There's a library of both vendor-provided and community-provided apps, and Homey still offers a few approaches to scripting actions, most of them super easy. Their older Homey Bridge is still around, but the new Homey Pro escalates everything except the bridge's monthly fee. They kicked that down to zero.
Okay,
That bridge subscription fee was to host more than 5 devices, but the fee-free Pro device count is unlimited. Really significant to my security priorities, Bridge used the cloud and Pro is strictly local. Homey Pro is available for about $400 at about $30 for the Ethernet adapter at Homey, Homey.app, Homey.app.
.app. Okay, there's we keep seeing all of these new top level domains popping up. App. All right.
Now, speaking of do it yourself.
Yes.
Kids play with blocks, but ye light cubes are still fun even when you're all grown up.
Yeah.
These cubes are set up with one face that lights and two sides with complementary magnets and power connections.
Okay.
They sent me one skinny power feed module for one end of the stack. It connects to a 12-volt wall wart that comes with what I take to be the anchor cube because it only has the magnet and connector on one side. That's called panel, which seems to be a 5x5 array of dots behind a diffuser. They also sent 4 cubes called matrix extensions, each with a 5x5 square pattern of lights, and one lensed light cube they call a spot extension. So those are the names. Everything about this is RGB. It's best controlled through their Cube app, but it's also compatible with Matter, Apple Home, Google Home, and Alexa. Also, for gamers, Razer, R-A-Z-E-R, Chroma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Now, for me, I turned this line of cubes into a date and time clock facing forward. I tried a lot of their available colors and patterns and settled on green and pointed the spotlight and diffuse light up so they could bounce an ambient glow.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see your fan counts on YouTube or Twitch, it can show you those too. I haven't yet figured out how, but I imagine there's some way to make the diffuse panel use a separate color and pattern to reflect the weather outside and maybe use a spot to flash alerts to something else, maybe bad indoor air quality. The six cubes that I got come in the Ye Light Smart Cube Kit for about $295 at Ye Light. That's YEELIGHT.com.
How big are those cubes?
About 3 inches on a side.
Okay. All right.
Roughly speaking.
All right. Cool. We've got a time for probably one more.
Well, good. This is a big one. This is the Pocket Pro Smartphone Meter and Scope Probe, and I'll go into that. You know how to say swing in Latin? It's oscillare. The root word to oscillate, which implies swinging back and forth, and to oscilloscope, which is a thing with wavy lines you see on almost every bad science fiction movie ever.
Very true.
Now, once you're familiar with oscilloscopes, the traces and patterns they display let you measure and identify many kinds of values. For example, traces can make it very clear when an audio signal or a power line is noisy, or an inverter is producing a series of pulses instead of a clean sine wave. Some of you are about to ask if there is an app for that, and there is, but it takes a companion product, and I just got one in. The Pocket, that's P-O-K-I-T. The Pocket Pro looks like an oversized test probe, but suddenly your phone has a wireless multimeter, oscilloscope, and data logger, and you can test in the field without having to disconnect things and haul them back to your test bench. It can measure from 1 millivolt to 600 volts, from 1 microamp to 10 amps, and when fully charged can log data for as long as 6 months. It's also good for measuring resistance, capacitance, and temperature, plus reading continuity and determining diode polarity. Its options add a lot more useful modules. Spectrum analyzer, anyone? It's a thoughtfully designed instrument. There's even a front white LED work light because testing so often happens in dark places.
Yeah.
The Pocket Pro, and I recommend it for anybody technological, including your kids, is about $250 on Amazon.
Oh, okay. Having seen the pricing on oscilloscopes, having seen the, I mean, that is an amazing deal.
Yeah,
portability is, yeah, I mean, this is next level. Okay, a lot of this stuff has been, so far has been, all right, this is good, interesting.
One other point, if you buy four of them, your app will show a 4 trace scope.
this is really, that is an amazing price point, and I'm very impressed by that.
Yeah. Anybody who's doing electronics work at all or getting into design or in school for it.
Yeah.
Great investment in your present and your future.
That's the voice of Marty Winston. He's got a bunch of these different things he's been doing the homework on and figuring out what are the good things for this year's holiday gift guide. Oh, yeah, definitely good ideas. So that's Marty Winston. This is Benjamin Rockwell. We'll be back with a lot more.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, December the 1st, 2023. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Their website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect meets Thursday, December the 7th, 2023. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 8th, 2023. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And their website is limac.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, December the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The phone number to confirm is 347-278-7320. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, December the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting, and the website is bcug.com. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, December the 14th, 2023. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. Happy computing, and Black Friday's coming up. The best buy may very well be what you don't buy. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy till we meet again, same time, same station next week.